J.T. Crowley is talking books. On the show, you'll hear from emerging talent and seasoned veterans from around the world.
Hello, everyone. I'm J.T. Crowley, and I'm really pleased to welcome back for the second time Hugh Hyland from Perth in Australia to talk about the second book that made up his late mother's experiences as a young person from Scotland and the events of World War II and her role she played in that war. This book, The Forbidden Zone, 1940, forms the second part of his mother's original manuscript. The first part was covered off in the previous interview I did with Hugh a few months ago. A book we talked about there was A Sprig of White Heather and A Scottish Lass. If you didn't catch that interview, then you can head to Talking Books show on Web Talk Radio and scroll down the shows until you come across A Sprig of White Heather and A Scottish Lass by Anne Angelo. And that's where you'll find that podcast. And Anne Angelo, just to remind you all, is Hugh's late mother. Now, Hugh himself was born in 1944 in the UK and in 1950 emigrated to New Zealand, North Ireland, for health reasons with his parents. The family lived in Hastings and Auckland. On the death of his father, a former British Army officer, in 1959, Hugh and his mother moved to Australia. And Hugh's life and career took him all over Australia until he finally settled in the Greater Perth area of the west coast of Australia. But as I said in my last interview, we're not here to talk about Hugh's path of life, but about the manuscript his mother wrote. So, Hugh, would you care to come back for the second time on my show and talk to us about your mother's second book?
Yeah, I'd be delighted. Now, I remember her writing it or typing it on a good old-fashioned typewriter in London in 1949, and she spent a lot of time doing it because she wanted her story to get out while everything was fresh in her mind. And then it basically got forgotten. We were moving around a lot. And then in 1978, which was, almost 30 years after, she dug it out and got a ghostwriter to assist her in not so much rewriting it, but adding to it. And then in 1980, 79, 80, I was in France on work, and then she came over and joined me in 1980, and we went up to the north of Scotland, which is where she came from, Invergordon, and we went down the west coast, and there was a newspaper place there, which is closed just a few years ago. And they had a copy of the multiple pages that they ran in 1940 when she, 40, 41, when she returned from France, just after she had escaped from the Germans. So that was also added to the book as well. And we tried getting it published, but in those days, unless you were sort of, you know, like a known author, it was pretty well hopeless. And it got forgotten about again for another 30 years. And then during the COVID lockdowns, I came across the manuscript in a briefcase. And I looked through it and I said, wow, you know, I wonder if anyone would be interested in publishing it. So I just asked out, and Ex Libris came on online and said, yeah, send us the manuscript, which I did, and it was in two parts. And they came back raving about it and say, yes, please, we really want to go ahead with this one. So that's where it all became. And in the meantime, the first part has got 7 book awards, and the second part, that which is this book, has got 5 book awards. And it's also, the first part has just got a some recognition. I only heard about it today. So it's all very well, accepted out there.
Which is really good news. Because the first book is different to this one that we're going to talk about, because this one is more detailed. This is about his mother's war years, and it's just absolutely gripping everybody. No, so let's go on and open the pages and let's ask you a little bit more about his late mother's book. Now, Hugh, there are 30 chapters in this second book your mother wrote. Now, we're not going to go into all the chapters, everybody, because we'll be here forever and a day. Because that's not the idea of the podcast. The whole idea is to give you a flavour of what the book is about. So what we're going to do is go to a couple of chapters, which Hugh and I both agreed on, and we're going to talk about them. So as you get the idea of what this book is about. Now, I'd like to go, Hugh, to the first chapters we're going to talk about. That was chapters 3 and 4, to start off with. Now, like most of the chapters in the book, they're short, everybody. Now, chapter 3 is headed up The Threat Approaches, and chapter 4 is headed up War. And when I look at this this book of yours, you know, your late mother's, who was put in charge of running the home in Lille as a private hotel for wealthy clients, France's economy was in a deep depression, factories closing, soup kitchens opening everywhere, but yet these were some people who had money, enough to pay for a private hotel for a holiday. So from a governess, that's what she was in the previous book, to a hotel manager, kind of, with staff and reasonably well-off guests, she started to run the home as a private hotel. So your mother has returned back from Scotland, and things don't go very well. Plus, returning to France, we're talking September 1939 here. So, Hugh, would you care to take the story here and tell everybody what's going on in these two chapters?
Well, basically, she came back. She was briefly in Invergordon when war was, pretty imminent. And this was in September, but the Germans didn't really invade until May the following year. They were waiting for winter to be over. So in the meantime, the BEF, that's the British Expeditionary Force, they had come and joined the French. And they were within the city or the town of Lille. And that's where she met up with Gerald, who she sort of then, became very much romantic with. And that was the early times. And then he had to go back to England once the Germans did cross over. And she was sort of left there, basically minding this hotel. And then the Germans sort of came down, and then all the hell broke loose, as it were.
Yes, because the character Gerald dips in and out, doesn't he? He comes for a few hours, and then, the pressures of war, and he has to go back.
Yes. So she actually bumped into him, literally. They had an accident. She was driving her car, and he was in a staff car, a British Army car, and they had a collision. So he became very concerned about her getting back to health, and then it developed after that. Yeah, it's got romance in the intertwined as well as part of the story.
Oh, it has. There's lots of stories going along here, everybody, in the storyline. Now, Hugh, let's move on to chapters 5 and 6, Return to Lille and Ambulance Driver. Your mother's back at the hotel, 241 Rue Nationale in Lille. Even, I believe, His Royal Highness, the then Duke of Gloucester, stays there. And, of course, we learn about your mother's decision to drive ambulances and some of her experiences. And I found that this part of the book fascinating, absolutely fascinating, everybody. Rather than me, tell you what's going on here, because yes, I've read the book, I know what's going on here, but I would like Hugh to tell you all what is going on in his mother's book in these chapters 5 and 6.
Well, before the Germans actually crossed over the border, there were lots of French and British Army people around. And she joined the ambulance corps, the French ambulance corps, And they were sort of going to and from between Lille and the Maginot Line. And she did it a couple of times, and both times when she got to the agreed meeting place, which was halfway, where she was supposed to meet another ambulance coming from the line, she got out, and luckily she did, because both times the ambulances were strafed by German planes. So the question is, did the Germans know something about these ambulances not being proper ambulances? And were they carrying something that was a bit different? So after two episodes like that, she decided that wasn't for her. So she quit.
Ah, I wondered why. Now, Hugh,
yeah.
I wonder why. Ah, there you go. And she had some quite, you know, well-known guests staying at the place, didn't she?
Oh, yes, they were wealthy and they were well-known and they were high-ranking and, yeah, some of them were a real pain in the neck, though. They were a bit more amorous than should be expected, but she sort of had to fend them off, and that was an amusing part of the story too.
Yes, all part of the life of running a hotel, everyone, for the well-off, the well-heeled.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know more, read the book. Now, Hugh, the story for me really gets going in chapters 10 and 11, headed up the refugees and fleeing from the German advance. Now, we're here May 1940-ish. I believe the German army has marched into Lille. She is worried about Gerald, with whom she has, as we already said, a romance, you know, a relationship with through the war. But that the war's put a bit of strain on that relationship, as wars do. And so she's standing on the balcony of the hotel with Marie-Louise, watching the endless stream of beraggled refugees below on the streets fleeing the German army, who are coming. They are on their way. And plus, you're talking about the journey to Paris here. So there's quite a lot going on in these chapters, everybody. You know, your mother is telling us about her life in that time of the war and her time of her life. You know, I found this gripping. What's your views here as to why your mother wrote these chapters, you know, this side of the storyline?
Well, she was very sort of moved by it all. And I remember her back in 1950-ish telling me about the story of when she was trying to get from Lille down to Paris. And they were stuck in all these lines of thousands of refugees. And then the Germans would come along with planes and drop a few bombs and machine guns from time to time, and there'd be craters and dead horses and you name it, and all the horrors and everything. And she was, you know, she was pretty well emotional about that. And about, you know, there were children there as part of the refugees, and some of them lost their parents during that. And she took a couple of them under her wing because she was driving down in her car with four, it ended up with four children and two adults. And, she, you know, she was just trying to get to safety. And when you sort of, you know, you've got the unknown following behind and then thinking, well, if they catch up, what are they going to do? And you sort of hear all these stories about all the bad things that are being done here, there and everywhere. It's a lasting memory. It's really, yeah. So she wanted to get the story out to others, like a first hand. This is what I went through.
Yeah. Now, the car, am I right in saying here, it was the Buick?
Yeah, I think that was the one.
I think it's the one, yeah.
I had a couple there.
Yeah, but the Buick, of course, it was her favourite car, wasn't it? The Buick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
She used to talk about that one, yeah.
Yes.
She inherited that as part of being a manager of the grand house, because the master had gone to Paris a couple of years earlier, and she was there running it as a small private hotel. So she had the staff, she had the car, she had the house. And yes, that was her car.
Yeah, and of course, it's a completely different life to what she was, you know, being a governess. And she had to remind, I think, some of the staff who stayed on, well, she's not the governess anymore. She's actually the boss. And some of them didn't quite take to her being the boss, did they?
Yeah, well, that was the second coming, because a few years earlier, when she came over from Scotland to be the governess, she had to sort of be accepted into them. I mean, she was sort of like a foreigner. And she got over that one and then became their boss, as you say. So, yeah. It all worked out. It all worked out.
It did. With a lot of stories, everybody. You want to know what those stories are? Read the book.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, Hugh, let's head off to the section of the book around chapters 18 and 19. As I said, everybody, there are 30 chapters in this book. They're all short. So these chapters are titled British Women Give Nazi Salute and Gestapo Officers Come to Dinner. And when I saw that title, I thought, I've got to go to this chapter, the Gestapo coming to dinner. So what's your mother talking about in British Women, you know, Give Nazi Salute? I take it this is your mother finding out the leak in the house, which is under constant surveillance by the Germans. Not a water leak, everybody. Leak of information. And, you know, was it the two young girls, one of whom she followed to the Gestapo headquarters? But for me, here, it's the storyline in chapter 19, duping the German Gestapo guys with one of the oldest tricks in the book in order to get their way that they needed. Uniforms, papers. This was guys being lured by ladies. It's fascinating. And I absolutely love this chapter, chapter 19. Do you find this chapter, you know, chapter 19, fascinating? And talk to us, Hugh, about the British women, you know, give Nazi salutes.
Yeah, well, in chapters 18 and 19, in order to exist, it was freezing cold in winter, and there wasn't any, wasn't enough food. So what she did was she'd go and kick a German soldier in the shins and get arrested and then thrown in the local jail, which is called the Loos. I've actually seen it when I went there from the outside. And she'd be thrown in there for several days, where she would actually get food. Now, what they were doing was there were lots of, well, not so much British, because if they had a British husband, then they were considered British, even though if they'd never been to Britain. So the Germans had all these ladies rounded up and sort of in the starving sort of situation, begging for, you know, anything that they could. And they said to them, if you would like a special treat of some type of food, raise your right hand. So they raised their right hand, and then photographs were taken, and then it was, you know, put into the local posters on the walls here, there, and everywhere, and the newspapers, that they were giving the Nazi salute. So it was all a bit of a trick. And that was one of the things that appeared in the Scottish newspaper later when she came home. But they were the sort of things that were going on.
And when I look at the book, when she was in the prison, she got fed very well, didn't she?
Well, there was a kindly wardress.
Yes.
And, And that comes in a bit later in the book. And it wasn't just a case of getting enough food. That the war dress was actually raiding the pantry that the Germans had all their luxury food as well as wine and bringing sheets and also books to read. And, you know, it was like quite a different sort of thing. So at that stage, yes, it was worthwhile getting thrown into jail for a few days just to sort of survive. And then what you could sort of save, like bread and everything, hide under her clothes so that when she left, she could bring it back for the others. Yeah, yeah. It was tough times.
Very tough times, everyone. Very tough times. Now, I think I've got this right. The resistance movement, which your mother was involved with, was always active in their attempts to outsmart, outwit the Germans, to whom every man and woman in France hated with a passion. In chapter 21, the Luftwaffe is mauled. I like the story of the newspaper in the cinemas. I thought this was brilliant. When the newsreels came on with German propaganda, I thought, wow, the newspapers. And if you're not to know what the newspapers are, well, let's get Hugh to tell you. But what I liked most about this section of the book was the kind, it was always says, the wardress who served your mother while she was imprisoned again, food, sheets, what luxuries. But could you explain to us about, you know, in the cinema, the newspapers and what was going on there?
Well, it was all German propaganda, and people would go to the cinemas, and there'd be a film on and maybe a newsreel beforehand that was produced by the Germans showing all the German sort of good things, which were all, you know, faked up, and all their likewise their how they were succeeding here, there, and everywhere. So the Frenchies, they basically didn't want to have a bar of this, so they started bringing in newspapers, and they would hold the newspapers up so that they wouldn't be able to see the screen. And of course, the Germans got very annoyed, angry, upset, infuriated. So they then banned newspapers. So then these came up with other ways, like, you know, closing their eyes during the whenever these newsreels and everything came on. So the Germans would then go and turn the lights on to go and try and find, you know, who's sort of leading all this and cart them away sort of thing. But it was a real them and us, you know, protest.
Yeah, you know, just a simple thing, just going to the cinema. You know, you had to be very careful those days, you know, of the German occupation. Now,
but especially there, because that being, if I can explain the Forbidden Zone, in the northwest of France, there was that little pocket around Lille, and from there to Dunkirk at the English Channel or the French La Manche. And that was where the Germans, once they came across the border, they went there in order to put together their invasion fleet, all their, you know, their barges and all their, you know, vehicles and thousands of troops and everything. The idea was that they would sort of go across as soon as it was safe enough to do so once the RAF was out of the way. So that whole area in the northwest of France was called the Forbidden Zone, because while France was sort of divided, like the top half of France was occupied and the lower half was not so much occupied but was under Vichy French government, that top northwest was really locked down. It was, you know, very difficult to get in or out, and if you were moving around in there, you were sort of subject to all sorts of harassment and extra sort of being dealt with.
Indeed. Now, the final section that I would like to go to, Hugh, is chapters 24 and 25. The Net Titans and Escape from the Forbidden Zone. Now, in the Net Titans, word has got out that all those with a British passport would be sent to concentration camps. Your mother, who had broken her parole, would disappear to a hiding hole in the house, leaving Marie Lou, the old woman, having to deal with the Germans who came looking for her. Plus, she learns that all British subjects are leaving for Germany the next day. Of course, the house was also hiding pilots who had been shot down. The Germans had the house under surveillance. But it's the letter your mother wrote to Mary Lou is interesting. So, Hugh, what was the letter about? And tell us about the photo of your mother in this part of the book, Old Clothes and Clogs, posing as Lucienne Juan.
Yeah, well, she had to get an alias because she was sort of known as, Anne Angelo, but she had to have a French alias. So there was someone who looked a bit like her, same age, same stature, and had left some while back. So she did that, and she had a wig because the real one had red hair. And she then had the story concocted, like the Germans were knocking on the door every couple of days, sort of demanding a search and where is she? And, you know, because they all knew that she had her residency card or identity card, and it hadn't been stamped that she was anywhere else. And she wrote this letter saying, and gave it to the housekeeper and said that she had gone to Paris with a German Gestapo person on leave. He had since returned to the Forbidden Zone, and she was staying on in Paris, and he was a senior Gestapo person who could vouch for her, and she could rely on him for any assistance. So when the next lot of Germans came to, look through the house and search for anything, they were given that letter, and they just, scratched their heads and said, "Oh, really? Okay, well, that's it for now." And, there was a lot of, deceiving going on. I mean, some of it worked and some of it didn't, but yeah, you had to be cunning.
Mm.
So that way he had an alibi as to why she was not in the house, or in Lille for that matter. She was down in Paris, wasn't she? Gay Paris.
She wasn't quite having a party, everybody.
No.
Not quite definitely. A party. Not. Definitely not.
She was hiding in the hidey hole that she had for all the escaped, the shot down British airmen.
Yes.
But, she was in the French resistance, and they had been sold out by a Russian lady. And that's why she was in hiding then, after, a year under the German occupation, because now they knew her. And they knew she was linked, and they had a price on her head.
They did. Her card was marked, and they followed her. So she had to be very careful, hence the disguise, everyone. Mm-hmm. Now, you've already said, what the Forbidden Zone was about and why it existed. I found that, the chapter 25... absolutely riveting. This is a powerful, tense scene here. It's how the resistance network tried to get your mother, Anne, out of France. The detail that your mother goes into, the detail in the planning and all those involved, and how those people, they put their own lives at risk, because if they were caught helping your mother, well, they would probably be killed, or, you know, or something, you know, very unkind happened to them. You know, their lives are on the line here. So they did their very best to get your mother out, but it didn't quite go according to plan. You know, circumstances, you know, overtook what happened. Because in those days, you had to rely on the weather, the timing. It all had to be right. So, Hugh, could you tell us a little bit here about your, you know, the escape here, you know, a little bit more detail about, you know, on the boat and then coming back again?
Well, she managed to get through the line that separated the Forbidden Zone, and she got down a bit further, and she was to get into a boat to cross over the channel. And they started off in the middle of the night on a misty night. And they were only part the way across when there was another flare-up of, you know, naval units between Germany and the Royal Navy right in front of them. So they had to turn back and land back in French soil again. So that was her first attempt to sort of get away. But then it was a case of she didn't know anyone in that area, and all her help, or the people that she knew could help, were back in Lille. So she had to get back to Lille. So in the first instance, she sort of got hooked up with a passing farmer on a wagon. He was taking his goods to market, and he was absolutely gorgeous to her. He sort of helped her, just like, you know, he passed her off as his niece, and he said, look, he goes up and down and through the border and all the rest of it into the Forbidden Zone, and he gets various people. He just knows them, and he gives them duck eggs and things, and they just sort of wave him through. He passed her on to another one of his colleagues who did the rest of the journey back into Lille. And that's how she got through. You know, she was dressed up as this fake woman, the identity, which absolutely looked like a hag. And she managed to get through everything and get back into her beloved private hotel, where she met a couple of the staff. Everything had basically closed since she had left a few days earlier. And then they basically said, look, they're looking for you. You can't stay here. You better, you know, hop it, go somewhere else. So that was the end of that chapter. And it was really nail-biting and frustrating and all in one.
Of course, your mother was always told, look, if this goes wrong, you know,
oh, yeah,
don't give us away. You know, no, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And that must have been very daunting. But, you know, what I liked, this when they were getting through the barbed wire, how they used the cardboard to make a tunnel through it so they didn't make any noise or didn't cut themselves. That was fascinating.
Yeah. It's. I think it's an army trick that, they would have known. But the other thing is, too, that just sort of, you know, whenever I read that, and I've read it a few times, I sort of think with great gratitude of what those Frenchies did for my mother to help her. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't.
And she wouldn't have survived a war either.
No.
Oh,
and we wouldn't be having this interview.
True.
So,
they're absolutely gorgeous and the help that they gave. Yeah.
Oh, it was wonderful. But they did put their lives at risk, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a completely different book to the first one. It's a lot more detail about the war years, what happened to her, the resistance, being betrayed, prison, you know, entertaining, coping with the German Gestapo. I found this book out of the two, for me personally, was a lot more gripping, and I enjoyed this one more. Now, I'm probably right in saying, Hugh, that there's no more of your mother's manuscripts lying around the place to come out for another book, is there?
No, that's all there is.
That's all there is, everyone. So would you suggest, Hugh, that people read, you know, A Sprig of White Heather, you know, A Scottish Lass first, then, you know, The Forbidden Zone 1940, or can they read them in any order? What would you say?
They can read them in any order because there's the introduction to each book sort of, you know, does sort of tie in some of the points. But there again, it also leaves them wondering, who's this Gerald? You know, unless they read the second book, they wouldn't know. But if they really wanted to sort of flow, you know, follow the flow, then read the first book first. Grows up, and then when she gets into Lille, and then when the war approaches, and then read the second book. You know, war has started, and she's trapped there for a year or so and has to get out. Because, you know, war came in September 39, the Germans came in May 1940, and she didn't get out until the middle of 1941. So it was a fair way into World War II.
And of course, I suppose you must have a look at the first book, because when she does, you know, go back home, her father is just as unwelcoming and, shall I say, evil to her. And to understand that, you need to read the first book and see all about her father's character. He wasn't a very pleasant person, was he, Hugh?
No, he just wanted to marry off his daughters, you know, and get for him. And he wasn't really affectionate. He was just, you know, and do a Scot.
So, Hugh, who would you like, you know, to see reading your books, you know, sorry, your mother's late books, you know, the ones that you've got published? Is there a market, you know, that particular, or anybody? Who would you like?
Well, from what I heard today, there's hundreds of books have been sold already, and it's in all formats. It's in the, it's on the screen, or you can do an audio book and listen to it just while you're driving your car. So basically, it's for everyone. And I think the younger generation, if they're in their 20s and beyond, you know, 30s, they would get a lot out of it too. And especially, you know, if you're older, like 50, 60, older than that, or even if, you know, you've heard stories similar to that by your parents or grandparents. It's basically for everyone. It's not sort of a, you know, put on a shelf and forget about type of or book, or two books in this case.
Would you like to see the second book be made into a film? Because I can see a film there personally.
I can too, and a few other people can too, but it's a case of the filmmakers. Well, not so much the film industry, rather than, say, I don't know, Netflix or those ones that are on the smaller screen. Because films tend to go for, you know, developed, you know, books, whereas this one is more for, you know, a television series. And you could probably make about six, maybe, episodes on television. And that would be really good, because that would then really get the story out to, you know, hey, this is an individual's first account of what went through and the Forbidden Zone, which most people have never even heard of. In fact, a lot of people haven't even heard of the Phoney War, you know, from the September 39 to May 40, where, you know, the Germans kept to their side of the fence and nothing much happened on the French side. So, yeah, there's things like that. It's a historical thing as well as a romantic thing, as well as a, you know, it's a loving story, and it's everything rolled into one. It's there for everyone.
It is. Well, let's hope somebody, you never know who's watching, will pick this up and thinking, I'll contact this gentleman and see what this is about. Wouldn't that be good?
Well, as I said, the two books have got 12 awards. And they've also got this other thing that came up this morning. I just heard about. I can't remember what it is, but it's a recognition. It's a literary recognition,
which is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah.
But I mean, the books can be got on Amazon. They can. They are some bookstores, but it's primarily Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think Barnes & Noble and a few others. But the idea is that you can, nowadays, what people do is they just go on Google and they go and get a mail order.
Yeah.
And you can do that from anywhere in the world. And if you're sort of wondering about, okay, the Forbidden Zone 1940, if you can't remember all of these ones, what was the other book? You just go and look up Anne. A-N-N-E, Angelo, A-N-G-E-L-O, Anne Angelo, and then her two books will pop up. And incidentally, the surname Angelo was because her grandfather was Italian.
He was, everyone.
Yeah, and although her father and her were Scottish, and the kids at her school used to give her heaps for wearing a Scottish tartan skirt, because they said, you're a foreigner with a name like Angelo.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a lot to it.
There is. And, of course, her, you know, it's the Italian background is covered off in the first book, everybody. So have a look at both books.
Mm.
Hugh, I have to say, it's been a huge privilege to chat to you again about your late mother's books. And in this podcast, of course, the second book, The Forbidden Zone, 1940. I've thoroughly enjoyed them both. But without any bias, I have got to say, I enjoyed the second book, The Forbidden Zone, 1940, more, because I think there's more detail in it for me. There was war, there was all sorts of things and all sorts of things going on. And the detail and the planning is just phenomenal.
Mm. And so, then right at the end, there's the nice conclusion, which I won't tell you about.
We're not going to tell you. If you want to know what the conclusion is, buy it. Buy the book. So, Hugh Hyland, thank you very much for coming on the show again. It's been a great pleasure. I'm JT Crowley. Thanks for listening, watching, wherever you are in the world. Until next time, stay safe.